Hey everyone, I'm Kelsey Snow, and this is Sorry I'm Sad, a podcast about grief, loss, and the importance of hope. We are back this week with new episodes after an unexpected hiatus. I had originally had this conversation scheduled for before Easter, but I ended up testing positive for COVID-19 the morning I was supposed to record it and spent the next 6 days locked in my room. You can probably still hear a bit of a congestion sounding in my voice, which is strange because I'm now 3 weeks removed. I feel fine, but I still do sound a little sick, which is frustrating. If you listened to the most recent episode I did before this one, it was about my stroke and it was with Chris, and you heard me talk pretty emotionally about needing someone to take care of me, because my role as the mom and the wife and the ALS caregiver is obviously to take care of other people. So, of course, the universe gave me that chance by giving me COVID, I guess. And for 6 days, all of my meals were delivered to my door. I had Easter cards, homemade, and candy left for me. I spent a lot of time listening to my little family exist downstairs without me. And guess what? They were fine. They were better than fine. It was maybe a little bit of a hit to my mom ego. But it was an eye-opening experience for me in realizing that I was harboring resentment for all I do and blaming my family for it rather than realizing that my resentment was born from me having zero boundaries. So all in all, my COVID experience was a significant learning one for my entire family. Luckily, the kids and Chris did not get COVID. My symptoms were pretty much a moderate to mild cold with a few days of a headache. Thank goodness for vaccines. And I learned that I can step back from things and they can still thrive. And then they have a better, happier, less resentful mom as a result. So what does it say that on the day I was supposed to record this episode with Dr. Darren Markland about COVID-19, that I tested positive for COVID-19? I think it mostly says that COVID is still, of course, everywhere and highly contagious. The pandemic that never ends is still disrupting our daily lives and killing many, many people, no matter how tired we are of it. Dr. Markland is an ICU doctor at the Royal Alexandra Hospital in Edmonton and has been in the trenches since the pandemic started. His Twitter account, at Dr. Dagley, that's D-R-D-A-G-L-Y, has swelled to more than 55,000 followers since he began recounting raw stories of patients he was seeing in his hospital. Here is one from September of last year. Dr. Markland often writes in quotations things he said to his patients and things the patients or their loved ones say back to him. So as I read this Twitter story, I'm just going to be adding, I said, I being Dr. Markland, and the patient's loved one said, just for clarity, as I read out loud. Dr. Markland writes, "I know you've been avoiding me," I said. "I understand why. Your heart must jump into your throat when you see the hospital's number come up on your phone. Please tell me he's getting better," the patient's loved one said. "Your father's heart is failing," I said. "He promised to help me with my schoolwork," the loved one said. "The tears are welling up in our eyes now, but I know how to block them." "You have to do everything," the loved one said. "He worked two jobs to keep me in school. He is shrinking now. Only anger bolsters his impossibly thin frame from collapsing. His fists are clenched. I stumble for a second, seeing my son in the flash of his eyes. That connection swamps me with empathy. I can't give into it, or I won't be able to go through with what I need to tell him. So I brace myself. I break the connection by stepping back. "We have been doing everything for over a month now," I say. "The dialysis is only buying us time, but his lungs are like concrete and he's shutting down." "He meant to get the shot," his son says. "I even booked him the appointment. He was just so..." "Don't agonize over the past, please," I say. It's then that his rage gives way to defeat. "This is not the first time," I have told him. "He's losing a parent." Over the course of the pandemic, Dr. Markland has used writing and cycling as catharsis. He has found purpose in shepherding patients to the end when their loved ones haven't been there to fill that invaluable role. He has learned and lost and worked to carefully share stories that would otherwise go unheard. It hasn't been easy. In April, he wrote on Twitter that he had decided, for his own mental health and well-being, to give up the private kidney practice he had grown over years of dedicated work. And he has questioned out loud multiple times if his sharing has helped or hurt more. Through it all, there seems to me to be a return to a foundation of gratitude and true love of life for Dr. Markland, of living in a pure, honest, and big way. There is hope, sure, and there is honesty about where there isn't hope. There is fighting a battle, even if you aren't sure you can win it, because it's the right thing to do. I'll never forget sobbing in a movie theater with my little girl on my lap, watching Frozen 2 a few years ago. Don't judge me. Chris was newly diagnosed and moms need to find their important messages wherever they can. As Anna sang, that the only thing left to do was the next right thing. And that's what the doctors and nurses on the front lines of this pandemic have shown up to do day after day, to their own risk and their own detriment. The next right thing. This is Darren's story. A quick reminder that Sorry I'm Sad is truly a labor of love for me. From finding guests and researching topics to preparing for interviews and recording and editing all the audio myself, a great deal of time, energy, and thought go into each ad-free episode. If you value this podcast and want to support it, please go to www.patreon.com/KelseySnow, that's KelseySnow, to become a member. Your contribution will help keep this work going, help keep it ad-free, help it grow, and give you access to the Sorry I'm Sad Patreon community. Good morning.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay.
Good.
Busy week.
Yeah. Have you been working nights this week again then?
I've been all over the place. I've been working nights and pulling some extra shifts just because we've got a ton of Omicron that's taking out some of our staff.
Yeah, I said that to my husband the other day. It feels like all the people that I knew who didn't get COVID at Christmas are getting it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of this is more infectious than measles and there's no screening, so people don't know they have it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When I messaged you to reschedule, I actually tested positive that morning for COVID.
It's funny, right? Like I it's a bad analogy, but I feel like I'm running, you know, through a minefield because I still do not, I haven't had it, but every single person that I know, like almost all the intensivists have had it. My biggest activity is cycling and I hang out with a group of, and every single one except one has got it.
Yeah.
So either I've had an asymptomatic infection or I'm incredibly lucky.
Yeah. I mean, I was shocked that my kids didn't get it, or my husband, which was, you know, the concern, the biggest concern. His lungs are actually his doctors don't think that him getting it would be any worse than anybody else getting it because his lungs are very strong still. So that's good, but still who knows, right? ALS is such a unknown disease. You always worry that like something's going to start the ball rolling.
I guess that's the biggest fear, right?
Yeah. But yeah, my son had a cold and I thought it was a cold. I kept testing him and he kept testing negative. Mm-hmm. And so then when I started to feel like I had a headache, I was like, well, maybe I'm getting what he has. And then the day before I tested positive, he and I both tested negative again. And then on the Thursday morning, it was like immediate positive for me and he tested negative again. So.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. He never tested positive. So maybe I got it somewhere else. Now you think it was him.
Yeah.
Well, I had been out with a friend the weekend before, some friends, and she tested positive the same day I did. So I wondered if I got it there. Because we were the only two in the group who hadn't had COVID at Christmas. And we were the only two who got it. So, but yeah, I shut myself in my bedroom and my husband and the kids didn't get it. I mean, my daughter is sick right now, but I don't know if she got what my son got, but she's testing negative. She's on the couch.
It's nuts. And I think that's the biggest challenge right now is, you know, when we started this whole thing out, you know, like, okay, we're going to get vaccinated. We'll reduce bad outcomes. And I was really happy with that idea. I thought, okay, now we can move on.
Yeah.
My biggest challenge now is just now that we know more about this virus, and I know I see worst case scenarios, but I've seen a lot of worst case scenarios. And it's not just the stuff that hits the unit, right? Like it's the long COVID. I have a nurse practitioner who got it, can't even go up a flight of steps. And she was perfectly healthy before. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you say? Like, we've done our best. Now we just kind of have to walk through the lightning.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's some of the stuff that I definitely want to chat with you about, because I do think that that's a huge, that's such a, for people, my friends and people in my community who have done, you know, they've all been triple vac, you know, had three shots, their kids have gotten two shots. They did all the things they were supposed to do. And everyone's kind of like, well, now what do we do? You know, figuring out how to be a responsible citizen while balancing your kids' mental health, your own mental health is so confusing at this point, right?
Absolutely. And the thing is, I don't think there is a right answer. The problem is the retrospectoscope, right? When someone you know and love gets diabetes from this, right? Like, like I think about it in reverse. I think about all the people that I treat with diabetes, and if there was a cure, if I could give it to them, I would. So there's a potential, you know, way of preventing diabetes that's very well known, and it's not getting COVID. But
yeah,
what do I do?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, this has been, it's been like, you know, such a long road now, and it feels like it's just never ending. It's just going on and on. And I know that you tweeted a couple weeks ago that like, maybe it was a few weeks ago now, that we're like in the sixth wave, which I think most people know, except for it's hard to get information now. And I think it's both hard to get information. If you aren't looking for it, you're not going to find it. And people are sick of it. They don't want to hear the information anymore. And so we're in this sixth wave. And I just wondered if you could talk about what's happening at your hospital right now.
Well, you know, it's one of these things where wave is actually a really good analogy, because when you look at waves, you can see there's clarity when they're big. But after you get wave and after wave, a lot of ripples and reverberations happen. And then all of a sudden there's noise, there's interference. Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing after 2.5 years is, there is signal from increased Omicron, but there's also a lot of other things that are happening, which are incredibly challenging. One, the medical system is a shadow of its former self. We have a complete lack of primary care now. Mm-hmm. So from a critical care standpoint, where I look down, I see people who have been getting sick for the past 2.5 years with chronic diseases that have been poorly managed. Mm-hmm. I see people who have been diabetic for years, haven't known it, come in with their first bout of diabetic coma. I see people with bad, you know, smoking problems, addictions. Our opiate toxicity is through the roof, the number of people who are dying from that. So yeah, it's there. It's stressing a system that's in the process of failing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people are being damaged as a result of the sixth wave, just progressively hammering us and sinking the boat.
Yeah. It's not even as much about people who are sick with COVID right now. It's about all the other things that went unaddressed or just didn't get as good of care, quality of care as they should have gotten, right? After 2 years.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And part of our conversation is, you know, so we got to move on with our lives. The realization I'm coming to, which is really a painful one, and I don't put it out there a lot, is that I honestly believe that this is a defining moment in humanity. And so we're never going back to where we were. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think this will have serious repercussions for things like life expectancy.
Yeah. So that kind of being said, I wonder, you know, we all talk a lot about, and we've talked a lot about it throughout this, like the notion of this being over, but what does that even mean anymore? Like it's never going to be over, right?
No, I don't think it will be.
Yeah.
And so you talk about the five stages of grief. I think we're kind of in denial right now. So be it, you have to, because we're seeing the other issues. My children are suffering like many children from 2.5 years of not developing properly, right?
Yeah.
My wife's a developmental pediatrician. She is busier than I am right now because kids are really struggling.
I mean, I wonder if you can speak to that, because I know that one of the things that I have read a lot about and heard a lot about, specifically with kids, is like, you know, an increase in eating disorders for kids right now, and how we should be balancing that weight of our kids' mental health and what they need developmentally with the risks that we're taking.
It's an asymmetric argument. It's kind of almost like terrorism, right? When you think about it, this virus can, you know, unilaterally take one of us out, and then we're single parents. That balancing act is tough to have. I know that my kids need to go back and do the things that they did. And we support that, right? We fully have done everything we can to prevent the complications. But, you know, I think we imbue some of our anxiety about the future of the world in our children. And it's tough to be aware of the problems, right? To teach your kids that, you know, you have to look after other people is important, but that imbues a fair amount of responsibility, which if it's not reciprocated, leads to a lot of stress.
Oh yeah. That stressed my son out a lot. He's 10 and he got very stressed out when he'd see people not wearing masks. As soon as he recognized, we explained to him, you wear a mask to help other people mostly. Yeah. Then he was very upset. Like, well, I'm helping them. Why aren't they helping me?
Why aren't they helping? Yeah.
Yeah. It's a hard thing to explain to a 10-year-old.
Well, and kids have a very defined sense of justice, right? Mm. That was my youngest, same exact thing. Why is this unfair? And so it opens some very challenging life lessons. And I think that's beneficial. But I can tell you, you know, I've been on the end of some very angry people. People have actually showed up at my front door. It leaves you wary when you go out and talk about these things. And a mask is a mark now.
Yeah.
And for kids, we don't want our kids to be targeted.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of that, I went through your, I did a very thorough comb over your Twitter account a couple of days ago, because I wanted to find all those stories for people listening. If you don't follow Dr. Markland, he writes a lot of stories about, like, threads about what's happening in his ICU with patients specifically your account went viral when you started sharing those sort of anonymous stories of things that you had seen that were pretty jarring, a lot of them. But in May of 2020, you tweeted, masks are like vaccines. You do it mostly for the sake of others. This isn't going to go well. And you were very right, obviously. And I just wonder, as a healthcare professional and as a doctor, how you reckoned with that, the lack of, like, basic sacrifice to help other people in the name of greater good, you know, just people just not wanting to help others. Like, how do you reckon with that? I know you've seen this happen in your hospital.
Yeah. I think what we do, is we cone down. We change our focal length. Mm-hmm. I've always said that humans are great in small numbers, but we don't scale really well. So my mental health revolves around, you know, doing things for people on a small scale. Mm-hmm. And it's important. I had to do a lot of volunteer work. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my tweets is, you know, I have the same angers about vaccine deniers as everybody else. But the second I walk into that room, I can't not feel empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's our fundamental humanity. So yeah. I guess that translates into denial on my part too.
Yeah. Maybe we all need a little bit of it to get by.
We have to. I think, you know, if we all could just look after our areas, tend our gardens, I guess, then all the fields would be green.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the first story, like a sort of patient thread that I found of yours, and maybe I didn't find the first one, but the first one that I found was in November of 2020. I'm just going to read it. It said, it's me, the respiratory therapist, and the bedside nurse gowning up together. Only three of us will do this to reduce the risk of exposure. Despite the layers of protective clothing between us, she can see the concern in my eyes, and I see the fear in hers. It's time. You can't keep this up for much longer. Tears. The tube? I nod. You will be asleep. You won't feel a thing. Promise? The effort of speaking is making her sats drop. I swear. Am I going to be okay? We are going to give you the best care. She catches me in a pause. Now her tears come in hot streams. She clasps her phone in her hand and lifts it up. Yes, you should call your son and husband. Just in case. More tears now. But now we are both crying. First of all, you're a wonderful writer. and that's certainly not the first patient story that hit you hard, but it was the first one that I could find that you wrote. And I wondered what sort of propelled you to start sharing these stories in this way.
I think one of the greatest challenges of this wave is that we've never had more ways of sharing knowledge. But my job precludes doing it.
Yeah.
And in fact, I spent the last 2.5 years walking a very thin line. Mm-hmm. To share stories, to the point where it became very uncomfortable where I worked. And I had to make sacrifices to do these things because my colleagues weren't completely on board with that. You know, there's this code of silence. You have to protect the patient's information. But our professional organization also has a code where we have a responsibility to our community and society to educate and advocate. That advocacy role is huge. So for me, it was always trying to find this balance between advocacy and not harming people. Mm-hmm. And that patient was really special because this was really the first, this was when the first wave was really starting to hit us. Nobody was vaccinated. We were all kind of scared. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we were learning a lot about how this virus worked. The biggest thing was its slow progression. Like in ICU, normally I get called in when people are, you know, near death. I put a tube in. There isn't a lot of, you know, prodrome. Mm-hmm. And I actually, you know, got to watch these people over days, slowly getting worse and seeing where things were going and have a conversation, develop a relationship. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it was really hard to quote unquote, pull the trigger. Because that had consequences. The second, you know, we do this unconsciously when people are in distress and agony. For us to put the tube in, all of a sudden dehumanizes them so we can get to work. Mm-hmm. Didn't have that luxury. We got to know these people and their families and their hopes and fears. And so we learned very quickly that when we put the tube in, it could be the last words that they ever shared. And so that became a part of our practice, is that we made sure that they had an opportunity to make that phone call. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that develop a relationship part was probably, I mean, already, like you said, just the fact that you had the opportunity to do it because of the way the disease progressed. But then on top of that, like you guys were their only, still are, you know, I guess maybe for the most part, like you're it, because they aren't able to have they haven't been able to have their families in there with them. And I think that that has complicated the loss for people and grief for people so much, is that, you know, I have in November of 2020, my husband had surgery to get a feeding tube because his swallowing muscles have atrophied. And there was some confusion about, like, I was told when we scheduled it that I could go with him and I could be there. And I was like, oh, great. So we planned for that. And then when I got to the hospital, we got to the like day surgery check-in. They were like, leave now, get out of here. What are you doing here? And I was like, you said I could be here. Nope, you have to leave right now. And it was this really like hurried goodbye then. And I just found myself like minutes later sitting in my car in the parking lot sobbing. Like, I don't know what's happening. I can't talk to him. And I thought, that's like, it's nothing compared to what so many other people have gone through. But I wonder how you've seen that element of isolation and being without their people as they're sick and dying, how you've seen that play out and how it's impacted this pandemic, and how it's been for you guys as healthcare workers to be the ones guiding them through that, through their death, instead of the people that they love.
Well, I think in the big picture, it's decimated us. It's probably the reason why so much misinformation is spread out. Death and dying is a big part of what I do. And I embrace it. I mean, critical care, 25% of people who go in don't come out. And initially I got into this because I loved the physicality and the procedures. And what I learned was, you know, that was fun, but it was hollow. What I really would sustain me through 20 years of this career was the connections that I made with families, like being kind of admitted into the inner sanctum and giving people guidance through probably the most challenging journey they take. That was what I enjoyed, helping just families move on. And all of a sudden have that taken away from us. And the challenge too was all the information kept changing. So there was so much inconsistency that people who were a little suspicious beforehand were a lot more suspicious when, you know, we told them they could come in or they couldn't, or the only time they could come in is when they were dying. I mean, that was a horrific thing. It almost felt like we were bribing people that as long as if we stop, you can come in and see your family. And it's still an issue. I think those scars have damaged our trust with the community irreparably. Those scars will last, and it'll take a long time to rebuild that relationship.
And so hard, because like you're saying, you guys are learning about this virus in real time, right? And then the rules are all always changing. But when you say that it's decimated you, I wonder if you can say more about that.
Well, like I derive a lot of professional, you know, satisfaction from taking people through the process. I know I'm not going to win everything, but one of the things I realize is that, you know, this journey isn't just the patient, it's the family. And if the patient dies, it's important to make sure that the family doesn't die as well. Mm-hmm. And what we got into issues with is now that there is separation, you know, the physicality of grieving was taken away. And I don't think you can do that. We are physical people. We need to touch and be held. And when we removed that, all of a sudden it became unreal. And so to have discussions about death and dying became impossible. And a lot of our nurses took on this role of kind of an emotional surrogate, which I think is unhealthy if you're not trained to do it. You need some boundaries. And they were just doing it on the fly. Mm. I think it's really contributed to a lot of suffering and loss of our nursing and paramedical staff. Yeah. Docs don't tend to step away physically, but they certainly do emotionally. And so we've seen a fair degree of just misbehavior amongst our physicians. I'm not saying lack of professionality, but you know, you can't walk out the door, but you certainly aren't mentally present when you need to be. Right. Everyone dealt with it differently. I personally, my way of dealing with it was writing and yelling into the void. That's Twitter, and sometimes hearing the echoes. Yeah. But yeah, no, we, it was just a very abnormal way to do medicine. Yeah. And we're starting to get some of it back. But like I say, it's going to take a long time to fix this.
Yeah. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about when you started writing and your colleagues pushing against you, and also, you know, or maybe being like, I'm not sure you should be doing that, and the kind of conversations you had around that, and even the kind of things you had to weigh in your own mind about making that choice to say those things. Obviously, you never use patient names and you never use any identifying characteristics. It's just a person that you're relaying an exchange about. But I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and what that's been like to sort of, like you said, you've been walking a fine line in doing this.
It's been educational. I've learned a lot about the nature of reporting. And it's incredibly challenging. The big thing was trying to figure out how much of this was for me and how much of this was for the public. And I think as long as I came at it from an altruistic point of view, then I could move forward. There was a tremendous amount of, I would say, pressure, almost a little bit of bullying from other physicians about this. Like, people genuinely appreciated it, but the challenge here was that we were in the midst of an antagonistic government who obviously had, you know, was putting pressure on administrators, and they were transferring it to me, and it's not their fault. Like, I think I want to be very clear that the people I work with were stellar. The teams I was with were stellar. And to the point where I would get backdoor communication saying, you know, the stuff you're saying is helping public policy. But, you know, here are some tips to keep yourself safe. And by the way, I didn't say this. Yeah. So, you know, I don't think I've ever felt so fractured. Between everyone had two purposes, and so did I, right? My purpose was to look after the patient, but realizing doing those things without looking after the public was, you know, in a sense, treating the symptoms and not the disease.
Yeah. Yeah. What did the response, cause I mean, like I said, some of these stories, especially early on, they went viral and then you kept sharing them. You know, what did the response to these stories tell you about? How did that weigh into whether or not you kept sharing, right?
I think the first one you quoted, she actually, when she survived and when she got out, she replied to that thread and was very happy to disseminate that information. Mm. In fact, I still follow her after all this time. And it's this beautiful longitudinal knowledge about what COVID is. She was my first, and now I kind of get to follow her in the community. Mm. These stories are always meant to, you know, speak to people's hearts, and try to break down a lot of the defenses that people put up, so that, you know, I can at least get the message to them. That's hard. I'm not a writer. I'm a physician. I'm not an artist. You know, I see things. It's funny how these skills have kind of developed, and it's only because for 2.5 years, I mean, I've been doing this 24/7. Like, the darkness that's in there has been dealt with just by writing, but it's all genuine emotions.
I mean, I'm a big believer, obviously, in sharing our stories, especially about these hard things, because I don't think we do our greater good, do ourselves any good by keeping these things quiet, because so many of these things are relatable. But there had to have been such a extra element for you in the way that, like, if you didn't, nobody else was saying these things, because there wasn't family in there to be tweeting about what was happening, right? Like, you were witnessing this, and is it going to just disappear into the ether, or are you going to, you know, are you going to mark it down? Is, you know, that's kind of the ultimately what it is, right? Like, does this get recorded in history, or does it get forgotten?
Absolutely. And I still fear that there, we've put up walls now that are almost insurmountable with respect to public health policy. And that it's really important. I spend a lot of time trying to decide if our health administration, specifically our chief medical officer, was which side they were on. Spent a lot of time just sitting on that fence. And that was hard, because you want to know that that person is in your corner, and I never felt that. And so once I kind of made up my mind where that person was, then at least I had clear focus to move forward about how I was going to say things and the way I was going to bring them up. But again, I guarantee you that every patient story is absolutely true. It was just trying to strip enough information off of it, but still connect with human emotion. That was important.
At one point you tweeted, "Is this even helping?" And I wondered what was happening for you when you wrote that.
That, I think, was during, you know, that's when we started to see a lot of anti-vaccination mentality up there. And you probably noticed that my feed has toned down a little bit with respect to COVID information, because the intent is to help. And initially, it was a clear focus to get people vaccinated, or at least, you know, early to prevent infection, and later on to get people vaccinated. I'm more uncertain about what the path forward is. I can't not see the medicine and read the literature. I mean, I lead with my heart. If you follow my feed, I love living life. I tend to do it as much as possible. I kind of believe that every day will be my last. I want to get back to that, but I've got a brain, and that brain doesn't follow the heart and everything. So I don't know. Is this really helping? Maybe initially. Now it's a matter of everybody just sitting down and talking.
Which is increasingly challenging, isn't it?
Well, we're increasingly divided, which is not good. We're divided politically and socially. And the pandemic has done a lot to do that. Again, I believe in the inherent physicality of humanity. We're not face-to-face. If we're not in each other's space, we tend to get it wrong.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to have a very heated argument on Twitter than it is sitting next to somebody and talking face-to-face, right?
Yeah, I'm a little worried that we're just hardwired to be asses if we're not face-to-face.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. So I know that we've talked about some of these stories, or I read that first one, but I wonder if you could tell me any others that come to your mind, the ones that really stick out for you, the stories that you've told on Twitter, or maybe the ones that you hadn't, you know, whatever you are able to share.
Yeah. Again, it's challenging. I think I can never give away specific cases. It's amazing how good people are at tracking things down. And that was the thing that amazed me, was people can take the scantest piece of information and with the internet figure out where things are.
Yeah.
I think one of our really challenging phases when we had a lot of people coming from northern communities who were frank anti-vaxxers. Mm-hmm. And we really had to just ignore the news, because you knew that when someone was coming from a specific town, you knew the circumstances that were happening there. And they were pretty horrific. I mean, there were COVID parties happening up north. There were people, you know, literally telling other people to get infected for the, you know, for immunity and for a higher purpose. And all of that was incredibly challenging. And so at that point, you know, just stopped looking at the demographics, mm-hmm. stopped asking the questions. In fact, I made a pledge to myself that I wouldn't ask anymore if people were vaccinated. Didn't help me.
Yeah. Didn't you write a story about that once? You just mentioned that somebody said, aren't you going to ask me?
Yeah. And in fact, that was the connection when I said no, that was the bridge that God built where I could actually start to have some legitimacy. And even though that person was sick, you know, they contacted me later and said, you know, I still don't believe in this, but I will listen to a lot of what you say, and I won't propagate some of these things. And their family actually, you know, received vaccine, which was one of, you know, small victories.
Yeah. You got to take them though, right? So the family did, but the patient didn't.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's a crazy time. And so what you're really talking about there is boundaries, right? And that's a hard thing when you're in that moment to have a boundary where you're not going to ask if somebody got vaccinated. Was it challenging for you, or was it freeing for you when you're kind of like, this is the way that I'm going to manage this?
It's challenging for me. Yeah. People who know me know that, you know, I have no filter. What you see is what you get. I'm pretty emotional. I'm very passionate. Mm-hmm. I'm quick to express joy and rage. I always apologize afterwards. So, you know, that legitimacy, I think, has done me better than it's harmed me. People know that, you know, when they're talking to a doctor, I am who I am. Mm-hmm. Like I say, I would be just as mad as anybody else, but the second I walk into that room, you know, empathy is there. You can't shield it. Mm-hmm. The benefit of wearing your heart on your sleeve is it feels everything. So I wasn't liberated. It was hard, right? Like, I believe certain things to be fundamental truths. I believe in vaccines. I believe in education. I believe in socialized healthcare. I believe in justice. I believe in health disparity. I work in an inner city hospital. Those are the hills that I'm willing to die on. And those are the things that are being the most harmed these days.
Yeah.
But why would you go to war if you're not willing to fight?
Yeah. But how do you find that balance between, you know, being that advocate and being passionate about these things and not letting them sort of pull you under?
Again, I think it's just scope. I have a little coffee group and I make coffee for people every Friday, you know, in a little park for free. I accidentally, you know, got paired up with a digital artist who has been taking some of the stuff I put out there on Twitter with my permission, and making it into really cool stuff and then selling it so the proceeds can help, you know, the Ukraine effort. Those things, you know, where you form connections and form community are fundamental, and it translates. Medicine's tougher because there's so many rules and power differentials, but I think we all do these things because we want to help. The little energy and sleep I had left over, I just dedicated to those things.
Yeah. I think that the hardest story that you've put out there on Twitter that I've read was in September of last year. And so you often write in conversation, you know, you write what the patient says, what you say. So this is what you wrote. "I can't breathe. That's what the patient said. I know we're trying to help you, you told him. It's a bad reaction to antibiotics, he said. No, you said, it's COVID and it's really bad. Silent tears streamed down his face. Fuck you, he said. It's okay, you told him. We will look after you, I promise. I need my mom, he said. Then you wrote, I shrink a little. Like, that one I think got me the most. And I wonder what that moment was like for you.
It was like stepping off of a precipice. Mm. Most of that was a script in my head, stuff that I had, you know, when you go into the room and you have a conversation, you steal yourself. You have a little script. Mm. With COVID, we said these things a lot. We got very used to it. But every so often, someone would find a chink in your armor, right? Someone would manifest just raw humanity, and all of a sudden, there weren't words in that script that covered that. And the second this, you know, this was literally a big, burly, you know, mm-hmm. and probably worked up in the oil patch, mm. you know, raised to believe in independence and strong thought. And when he broke, when he totally realized that regardless if it was COVID or whatever, he was really, really sick and he wanted his mom. Like, he mm-hmm. literally, that got me. Yeah. Right. All of a sudden it wasn't on the script anymore. I legitimately felt really bad for him because yeah. I think he honestly believed this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably one of the things that can keep you in that space of empathy and compassion, right? Is we are assuming everybody is doing their best. mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you process a lot of this by writing. I write as a form of catharsis myself. Since my husband was diagnosed, I find it's, you know, people will say to me like, that was so hard to read. And I'll say, that's funny because after I wrote that, that's when I felt the lightest. You got to get it out, right? Did you write before at all? Like, did you write in this sort of way as a way of processing before COVID?
I wrote poems to woo my wife.
That's awesome. And it worked. Yeah, I think that counts.
I read big books. I just never thought I was good at it. I don't think I am. I spend a lot of time thinking about things. I'm blessed with this gift of only requiring 4 hours of sleep every night. So,
oh man,
time to think about things.
Yeah, I guess so. And so I know, so writing, and then I know that you are a big cyclist, and I know that you're being outside and being on your bike has made a huge impact. But I wonder if you can just talk about how you've looked out for yourself in this.
It's funny, right? I've looked at, you know, how everyone seems to have gained a little bit of weight during COVID. It's been the other way. I don't know how much you know about cycling, but I kind of started it just to get back and forth to work. And then the trips got longer and longer. And then I'd find these little side routes. And then, you know, all of a sudden I bump into people who were on the same routes and started riding with them. And then I became part of this cycling club. And within 2.5 years, I'm destroying these little 20-year-olds because I've never, ever been fitter in my entire
life. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good. I keep going back to the physicality of humanity. And clearly, you know, writing for me is kinesthetic learning. I've always used my hands to put things together. I believe the brain and the body are so connected. Mm-hmm. And so getting, just dealing with negativity and anger, you know, I could either punch a wall or I could ride my bike until the wheels came off. And so I've looked at some of the stuff that my colleagues have gone into, and I won't name names, but you know, they're sicker, they've done some things, marriages have collapsed, relationships yeah. have fallen apart. And I'm not saying I got it right, I just got lucky. But you know, I've gotten closer with my wife, I've gotten closer with my family, and I can ride my bike faster than a lot of 20-year-olds. So there have been pluses to all of this. But yeah, I think just there's this thing that the Japanese do. My last trip before kind of the world shut down was to Japan, and the shirin yoku, I think, is the term, which means forest bathing. Okay. And it's clear that I've been doing this for years. And Edmonton is a fantastic town if you want to find little paths that take you into evergreen patches. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've done. Like, I found little hidey holes just to figure things out and write stuff down. And it's been really good.
Yeah. I'm sitting here thinking about, I've been reading a lot of Brené Brown lately, and she talks a lot about the relationship between gratitude and joy. And a lot of the things you're saying make me think about that. And I wonder what your relationship is with gratitude, if that's something that you think about a lot, because she talks about how a grateful person is a joyful person, not the opposite way around. And it sounds like you're really good at sort of leaning into those small moments of joy and really appreciating them. And so I wonder your thoughts on gratitude.
I think you've said it all. My wife, like I said, is probably the smartest, most, you know, empathic person I know. And because she works with kids who are inherently beautiful and makes them better. And she has, you know, obviously we're connected because, you know, there are these things that manifest as love, but she certainly knows how brains work, right? How we cognitively process. And as much as I just go by things by feel, you know, I'm kind of a guy who has to light their hair on fire to figure out it's hot. she sees all this stuff, and I think that's why she tolerates me, is because she knows what I'm doing is inherently good and she knows the science behind it. But gratitude is one of the things that she coaches her kids, right? Just self-awareness and mindfulness. And, you know, it's probably pretty clear that I have a little bit of ADHD that I self-manage with exercise, but those things are important. To be grateful is, and aware is, the best thing you can have. And sometimes you do have to light your hair on fire to wake up and see that, you know, it's good not to be burnt. Don't do that literally, I think.
Yeah.
But like I say, I mean, I've derived a tremendous amount of strength from my family.
Yeah.
And have been very, very lucky to have survived this, right?
Yeah.
Like there were incredibly dark moments, right?
Yeah. And I wondered if you could share some of those. What were your darkest moments? What did they look like? And how did you propel yourself past through them?
I guess realizing that you have limits is one of them. I've always had, you know, my ability to not require a lot of sleep has been my superpower. It's probably why I'm self-selected for this career. And I've gone through really hard training and not been tired. But I remember very clearly during our Delta wave, where we were running 5 ICUs and we had like 60 patients, and, you know, people were dropping. And so all of a sudden it became, you know, who's going to stick around? Who's the strongest? I hit a wall right there. And I thought, this is, you know, all of a sudden when you have no resources left, you start thinking some very crazy thoughts. And none of it was ever suicidal. But there was just this feeling of utter loss and hopelessness, right? Like we just keep seeing the curve go skyward in a government that was non-responsive. And in fact, felt that we would just look after things regardless. You know, when one of our nurses, you know, committed suicide, right? That was horrific, right? People were just ice cold. That was hard. And of course, I was protecting myself the whole time and kind of hiding a lot of that stuff from my family. And so, you know, when I broke down, you know, horribly. Not, I guess, you know, it wasn't a nervous breakdown, but to open up and just let all of those things out, because you feel like you're protecting everybody else.
Yeah. By not saying anything.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, my wife isn't on Twitter. And in a way I felt almost that, you know, writing all these things with her not present was in a way cheating.
Sharing, 'cause you weren't sharing those things at home with her.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, that was a crisis. And it culminated in me, you know, realizing that I couldn't do, you know, my kidney practice anymore.
Right.
And so to finally realize that was enough, that was huge, because doctors, their identity is wrapped up in what they do.
Yeah. And
to decide that that was time, mm-hmm. that was a decision. That was like life and death, because you're accepting kind of your limits and your own mortality at that point. You know, this is something that I built, and I had looked after some of my patients for 15, 20 years. I've watched them, you know, come in. I've shepherded them through chronic diseases. I've literally put their dialysis catheters in. Mm-hmm. You know, I got them referred for transplant. They'd show up after they got their new kidney. I'd see them in the ICU when things went wrong after the surgery, like yeah. cradle to grave stuff that I finally said, you know, it's time to let that go.
That's a lot. And I think when you're a doctor, you stopping something come, you feel that sort of like pressure, like it's at the expense of somebody else. Right. And so that's an extra weight there. It's not just like for you, it's for you to take care of yourself. You're going to stop taking care of other people. That's complicated.
Yeah. You just hit the nail on the head right there.
Yeah. That's hard. Yeah.
There's a tremendous amount of guilt. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason was, you know, my practice had burgeoned because of the loss of primary care. Mm-hmm. So in the pandemic, I was looking after three times the number of patients I had beforehand during the pandemic, because there were no family physicians anymore.
Right.
And then, you know, knowing that if I didn't look after them, no one would. And then realizing that I was going to send them out to the hinterland. Oh my God. It still bothers me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure that people are always more compassionate toward you than you are toward yourself in those situations.
They are, but you know, like I remember very clearly, like my office staff decided whether it was good or bad to kind of, not that you have favorites, but you have patients you looked after for a long time and had, you know, relationships with. And so for my last day in clinic, they kind of lined up my greatest hits, and man, I bawled the entire day because mm-hmm. it was goodbye after goodbye after goodbye. And everyone was gracious, but you know, underneath it, there's a little bit of fear.
Yeah.
Who's going to be there for me now?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And that's hard. But I had to choose. If I didn't, then, you know, all of a sudden I'd be nothing.
Right. And
to make that choice had to happen. But man, it was like Sophie's choice. Not yeah. my children, but.
Yeah, no, I understand what you mean. You know, we've talked about sort of the notion of people not being willing to take care of each other with something as simple as wearing a mask. You've seen the worst bits of humanity. In those moments in the ICU when people are telling you, you know, F you, because they're sick, and you've been a part of this healthcare system as you said, it's in the midst of failing is how you described it. I wonder, where do you see hopefulness right now? Because it's so important to see that still, right? That's the only way to keep going.
Yeah. Every time I work with medical residents, trainees, I see hope. I mean, just this generation is so much more aware of the things that I've just figured out. You know, when I look at who staffs our intensive care unit, literally over the last 10 years, we've changed who we are for the better. We used to be a group of, you know, white, inherently, you know, males mm-hmm. who were very old school. And I won't say that's bad. That was the generation, but, you know, we brought in diversity. And diversity is tough because you think, you know, you, and you think, mm-hmm. oh yeah, I'm open-minded. And then people challenge you and it makes you a little angry until you figure out what's making you mad. Right? What makes mm-hmm. you mad is that you've been doing bad things, or at least inequitable things in the past. And so just looking at our composition of intensive care unit attending staff, I know that we're heading in the right direction. We've just hired a new person who's going to be fantastic. Just looking at people who get in this continually for the right reasons with hope and want to fix things. Teaching is what keeps my cup full.
You've been right about a lot of things as this pandemic has gone on. Like I read that mask tweet, and there are many more of them like that, where as a doctor, you've kind of seen what was coming. What do you think the future looks like, you know, right now in the healthcare landscape and for, you know, just in general, coming at this point in COVID?
That's a way harder question, right? It's easy to be right about, you know, big things, right? We drop a rock, there's going to be a crater. That makes sense. We're looking at now the finite reverberations, and that's really challenging. And like I said, part of the reason why I haven't been as visible on social media is I honestly don't know. There are aspects to this disease that are very concerning. There are aspects to our healthcare system that worry the heck out of me. I think we're in for a very challenging decade at least. And I fear for my kids. That drives me. I'm really worried about them. They're good kids. They're smart. I mean, my 18-year-old is acting like a typical ass, but he's a good person. I think if we don't make substantial changes, COVID will be the least of our problems.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes there's no way to say, oh, it'll all be okay. Right.
Well, not to turn the camera around, but, you know, you're on a journey as well. And you know where that journey is going to end. It's just how the road takes you. I deal with a lot of hope in my career, and some of it is helpful. Some of it is truly toxic. And the challenging part of my job is when to go in and take that hope away. And nobody wants to, because that inherently seems cruel, but sometimes it has to happen. False hope with respect to COVID and healthcare is going to be harmful. It'll be worse than knowing how bad it is right now. What kind of position we are in and how innocent people will literally die as a result of preventable diseases if we don't turn this around. We are truly, not to turn it into a political situation, but you can't run medicine like a business. It's not designed to make money. And every time you hear, you know, bottom lines and cash, you know, somebody is skimming. That's where we are right now.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about the stories that you've seen and how you're doing. I think that at this point in the scope of the last 2 years, I would imagine that most healthcare workers feel pretty abandoned.
I guess so. I mean, it's not horrific, right? Like, I look at the good things, right? Like, unlike most people through the pandemic, I had a place to go and people to work with for two and a half years, right? I got to go out every single day and do the things that I loved. It ain't all bad. And I mean, we're not all damaged. I think in general, the whole world has been a little baked under this, you know, under the sun. But I'm not without hope. I just realized that, you know, it's a big hill we got to climb.
And
I'm up for the task. I'm going to keep climbing it.
Yeah. Good thing you got those strong legs from all that biking. You made it to the top of the hill. I bought a Peloton during COVID. So
did you? That's good.
Basement biking.
Yeah, no, hey, I get it. You got kids.
Yep. Can do it whenever. While she's on the couch with her fever, I can go.
Yeah, you just
get sweaty. Perfect. Well, I really, really appreciate this, Darren. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, no, it took us a while to get there, but
yeah, well, COVID.
Yeah, I enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for all the work you're doing.
Yeah, no, and I wish you the best. Telling these stories is super important, and thank you for this.
The truth is, there is sadness and loss and destruction all around us. There are so many things to worry about, so many battles that feel insurmountable. We have to seek out the good. That was my takeaway from this conversation with Dr. Markland. Pedal your bike with abandon, stop to see the sunrise, make coffee for your friends in the park. Find the joy and lean into it. I mentioned in this conversation Brené Brown's work on the relationship between joy and gratitude. She said something on her podcast, Unlocking Us, a while back that I think of often when those little sparks of joy ignite in my chest. Joy, she said, is additive. Leaning into and experiencing joy creates resilience. It reminds me of Mary Oliver's poem, Don't Hesitate, and I thought reading it would be a good way to finish up today's episode. Oliver writes, "If you suddenly and unexpectedly feel joy, don't hesitate. Give into it. There are plenty of lives and whole towns destroyed or about to be. We are not wise, and not very often kind, and much can never be redeemed. Still, life has some possibility left. Perhaps this is its way of fighting back, that sometimes something happens better than all the riches or power in the world. It could be anything, but very likely you notice it in the instant when love begins. Anyway, that's often the case. Anyway, whatever it is, don't be afraid of its plenty. Joy is not made to be a crumb." A last reminder that if you value this podcast and these conversations and want to support my work, you can go to www.patreon.com/KelseySnow, that's KelseySnow, to become a member. For the monthly cost of one latte, you can help keep this work going, help keep it ad-free, help it grow, and get access to the Sorry I'm Sad Patreon community. Thanks, as always, for listening. The past is now.